Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. How are you? When I launched this podcast series, I said that it would be a mixture of conversations with people who I adore and admire, as well as solo episodes. I realised I haven't actually done a solo episode since the first instalment, so I'm feeling a bit introspective today, and I wanted to give a cheeky extra dose this Sunday, this rainy grey Sunday, and just share a few thoughts of what's been going on. So at the date of recording, it's Sunday the 10th of May, and for me and for many people in the black and brown communities, we have been experiencing collective grieving, and it's been really heavy. It's been extremely heavy, and as somebody who chooses to be an anti-racism educator and take on this work, and I will caveat that for a short period of time, it doesn't mean that I am immune to the trauma that racism carries, and the trauma that I'm talking about specifically is the unprovoked attack and murder of Ahmaud Arbery. And if this is the first time you're hearing that name, hit Google, and then I want you to ask yourself why it's the first time you're hearing that name. And Ahmaud was a 25-year-old black man who had gone out for a jog in February to get some exercise, as we all are right now, getting our daily dose of exercise whilst being on lockdown. And he was chased and violently killed by two white men. Even though there was a video of the premeditated attack made available to the police 24 hours later, it was only because that video was leaked to mainstream this week, and spearheaded by anti-racism campaigner Sean King, who has a huge platform over nearly 2 million followers, and showcased what had gone on, that they put pressure on the police force to make arrests of those two men. So those two men who killed this young black man who was out for a jog purely for being black were living their best lives in their houses, and only have arrests been made because this video has gone mainstream. Can you imagine if there was no video? Anyway, holding on to this global experience of just witnessing, and the video did show the murder, and I am not watching it, and I don't advocate that any of you do either, but the parents gave permission because they wanted people to see how black bodies do not matter. That in itself, in its entirety, is devastating and heartbreaking, and you feel it viscerally in your body. Coupled with the fact that the police had this evidence in front of them and they chose not to make arrests. That is the bit. That's why I do this work. This is the power of systemic racism is, as far as I'm concerned, a bigger virus than something like coronavirus. That is the problem with our society. And we've been troubled with this since the test of tide, since time began. And it will not change unless we all consciously take steps to do something about it and to be aware of it in the first place. So what's been really painful, aside from the collective grieving of what's been going on in America and what the world is seeing globally, this also coincided with the attack of a black man in Manchester in the UK who was tasered by the police, seemingly using unreasonable force. There's another video floating around. So within 24 hours, I'd been aware of what had gone on in America, and I've been sent the video of this black man being tasered in front of his very young toddler, little girl, who was in complete trauma, witnessing her father being treated like an animal by Manchester police. On top of that, we found out in the news that black people are four times more likely to die or be severely impacted by CB19 than white people, with no real investigation as to why. We know why, systemic racism. If you remove all of the fact, they looked at the data, stripped the data back. This data is from the Office of National Statistics. And when you remove things like pre-existing health conditions, when you remove socioeconomic conditions, the stats are still overwhelming. And to me, it's highlighting what has already been laying there in wait around the disproportionate way we are impacted in healthcare and treated, and how this can have detrimental effects on outcomes. Again, none of this is new. What this pandemic is doing is highlighting disparities that already existed and haven't been dealt with, because we, especially here in the UK, we continue to find it so offensive to talk about racism that we don't talk about it. And we get more offended by calling out racism and asking people to look and self-interrogate than the actual racism itself. And that has got to stop. It is literally costing people their lives. I've been working with a mainstream news outlet, and I'm really hoping that they run with this news story. But they follow me. I've worked with them before. We've done documentaries and I've done media expert commentary for them previously. So they follow my work. And they reached out a few weeks ago and they asked me if I thought the disproportionate treatment that people in ethnic minorities, particularly black people, has anything to do with racism. I said, yeah, it's hugely, of course it's multifaceted, but it's hugely indicative of racism, because what happens when we're under pressure, when we're in an experience like this pandemic now, when we're under more stress, we go into this heightened state of fight, flight and freeze mode. We go into this heightened state of feeling like we are under attack from the virus, right? When we go back to that primal state, when we go to that tribal state, we go into them and in us in mode. We then start to act from our emotional biases. When we're not thinking holistically, we're making emotional decisions, and biases that have been laying in wait, inherent racism that has been laying in wait, is rising right to the surface. Even if it's not conscious, it impacts our behaviour. So as part of this work I've been doing with this news outlet, they asked me if I thought the disproportionate treatment was as a result of racism, and I said yes. And they said, where is the evidence? And so I then went on to show them the reams of evidence of the disproportionate treatment and outcomes that people in black and ethnic minorities experience in the UK. The race disparity audit, for a start, reams and reams of data from mental health charities about black people being more likely to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act, being over-medicated. And if you've listened to my podcast with Mars, you will have heard about the Embrace report and black women being 5 times more likely to die. How many more stats and data do we need before there is action? This is my problem with the UK. We're so busy gathering data and stats. How many of us are taking action with this information that is already there? So I said that to them. I expressed this to them. And I said, also get curious. I've given you these stats and data, I've given you imperial evidence. When I talk about imperial evidence, that's lived experiences, stories from people who are impacted by the stories that we're seeing and hearing their personal accounts, and I'm giving those. And they say, we still need more evidence. Ask yourself, as a mainstream news outlet, why I've given you stats, I've given you data, and I've given you some imperial evidence, you still want more evidence. How much more evidence do we need before we start taking racism seriously as a public health issue? Because it is one. And so the next thing they said, can we have a phone call? And so I said, you know, this is really important. This really uncovers what is going on in mainstream media with biases, with any other news story, even if we don't have full data, full research. When something is a news story, that means it's current and it's happening now. If people are CV19 in something that's happening now, we're not going to have all the data available to us because we're in it now. So rather than uncover this as part of a story that could be contributing to some of these disparities as something to raise awareness about and to get people thinking about. They don't want to talk about it because we haven't got the evidence yet. These kinds of things are what impacts perception, what also builds, because we're not really talking about what's going on underneath the surface in terms of this disproportionate treatment. We're not really talking about that. We're victim blaming. We're saying, oh, well, it's because black and brown people living multi-generational houses and they're crowded and they're all poor. We're not all poor. We don't all live in multi-generational houses. And yet these disparities are still present. So let's start looking beneath the surface, shall we? Because if we actually care about addressing this as a public health issue, then we'll be looking at all angles, whether they make us feel uncomfortable or not. Really, really interesting few days. And so it's been heavy. I think people forget that I am, whilst I do this work, because I feel that if I don't do it, we'll still be in the same situation and I don't want to leave this earth having not contributed. I am still not immune to it. You know, it still impacts me. So I took a bit of a hiatus from the Instagram since Thursday and it's done me the world of good. A lot of what I talk about in my training is the importance of building resilience, and one of the biggest tools to do that is by practicing joy, like intentionally seeking out and practicing joy. It doesn't mean that I don't care about the trauma and the impact of what's going on in the world with people who I love and also myself, but it means if I am going to undertake this work and do it in a way that's sustainable, I need to be well, and everything around us is making, if we get succumbed by it, it is very quickly to see how that can start having a negative effect on mental health. And if you followed me for a while, you would have heard me talk about stats and data. You would have heard me talk about how racism is trauma and can show up on the brain as PTSD in the same patterns that it's seen in soldiers who served in war. You would have heard me talk about the disproportionate amount of black women in particular who experience mental ill health, such as depression and anxiety. These studies aren't inconsequential. There is something contributing to the fact that we are more compounded by illness. Because everyday racism is not addressed. It's minimized, it's battered away, it's gaslit, it's ignored. So yeah, I don't actually know where this is going, but I just wanted to share, to give you an insight into what goes on in my world every day. And beneath the surface. So last week seemed to just have so many things happening. And on Friday, I had the pleasure of teaching, holding space and doing a little bit of anti-racism teaching for yoga students and yoga teachers, people who are invested in wellness and many who want to be leaders in the field and go on to be yoga teachers or who already are and just deepening their practice. And one of the things that came up with a colleague of mine, Susan Atte, who you've heard me speak about before, she's on the second episode of this podcast series, I reached out because one of the things that happens when these huge violent murders happen and they are globally reported is that we feel it in our communities. And so I'm reaching out to some of my other black and brown colleagues and saying, are you okay? And we are just experiencing pain, anger and frustration. She said, I am furious because once again the wellness industry is silent on this matter. And I had was doing this training with the yoga students and teachers, and I said, if you are wanting to lead by example in this industry, you can't keep continuing to preserve wellness just for white middle class women only. Wellness is about collective healing, and if any group or community of people are being dehumanized, are being treated as subhuman, of course that is going to have an impact collectively. You can't cherry pick and choose who wellness is for. It's for all of us. And if there is a community of us that are disproportionately being impacted by trauma on an ongoing basis, then wellness should be preserved perhaps for the community who most compounded. Why aren't you speaking up about it? This is about wellness. Why aren't you raising awareness about it? You can't just bypass for the positive and kind stories only. That is so violent. It's so violent. But there is an expectation, or at least an assumption, that by talking about things that are negative or upsetting, that will invite negative and upsetting things into your life. That's coming from a place of supreme privilege. Because of course it's not. Joy and pain can coexist, just like they do when we think about attending a loved one's funeral. Joy and pain does and can and needs to coexist. It's the full range of being human. The full range of being human needs to allow for grief and anger and pain and rage and sadness, as well as lightness and joy. We can't bypass one for the other because we worry about energy. It's just the complete opposite of what wellness should be about. So to hear those, to be able to have and hold those conversations with people who are going to be leading in the wellness industry at a time like this, felt more pertinent. And what else went on last week? It feels like a big week. Oh yeah, the other thing I wanted to talk about. So in my Courageous Courage course that I do for black and brown women and people of colour, we finished that on the 1st of May. And a huge part of what we were talking about was the need to find joy so that we can help manage to learn to navigate everyday racism without it having such a detrimental impact on our physical and emotional well-being. Because sadly, racism is not going anywhere anytime soon. I wish it was, but it's not. So we need to find ways to live with it and to, when we're able to and have the capacity to, not tolerate and to speak our truth. Because often what leads to illness, biting our tongue, unexpressed anger is not speaking our truth and becoming subservient and maintaining the status quo for a peaceful life. But we spoke about the impact that speaking your truth as a black or brown person, the impact particularly with white women that this can have on relationships. And it was a big subject on the course, and it was something that really troubled a lot of participants, just not being able to speak openly and honestly about how their friendships, how people in their lives who are often closest to them, or at least have been for up until a certain point, are the ones who cause them the most pain, and how unable they are to have conversations about racism with them because their friends just shut it down. And this dialogue came up over and over again, and we did some work around how to address this. So I then decided to run a poll on my Instagram, and I said, look, this is for BIPOC people only. How many of you have noticed that starting to speak your truth, speaking up on how racism impacts you, is having a detrimental impact on relationships with white friends? And do you know what the response to that poll was? 91% have felt that it has had a negative impact on their friendships and have had to let some friendships go because their white friends are incapable of being able to hear them when they say, I am in pain and you are hurting me with your race, you are hurting me with your racism, or this is how racism impacts me. 91%. And so it came up a lot in Courageous Courage, and I talked about some of my own personal experiences with some friendships that have not survived this. And when I say this, me holding my friends, or at least trying to encourage them and to tell them that they're behavior is hurting me, and some relationships not surviving that. Really sad. And there's been a grieving process that's gone with that, but it's really, really sad. But it did make, you know, part of the conversation I had is that you cannot sacrifice you speaking your truth in a way that is served with love. I think that's very important, because the people who are in our lives who are closest to us often hurt us the most. We obviously love them, right? If you cannot speak your truth and serve with love and let a friend know that their behaviour is hurting you, If you cannot speak your truth and you carry on biting your tongue, then you're not being yourself. You are internalizing their bullshit. And it will have a negative effect on your mental and physical health. And I speak from personal experience on that. And so it also means, what do you need to do to protect yourself in terms of putting up boundaries or letting go of that relationship entirely? Which is really sad. But it also made me start thinking about some of the relationships where I've had to make these decisions and am making these decisions now. It's really sad. It's really painful. And I was talking to my husband about it. I mean, my husband is hilarious. I'm an empath. I care deeply about human beings, sometimes to the detriment of my own well-being, but I care deeply. Whereas my husband, it's not that he doesn't care deeply. He's able to detach far easier than I am. And I was talking about one friendship that is weighing on my mind, particularly around this period. I did a little experiment. I did this little experiment just to, you know, we often ask each other as friends, how are you? And there are only a select few of friends who ask me that, and I know that they want to hear the truthful answer. Otherwise, we just go into this menial sort of automatic pilot mode where we ask someone how they are and we expect their response to be fine or okay or good, and then we move on. So I did this experiment. A few friends had asked me how I am. I thought, you know what, I'm not going to do the usual frivolous, I'm fine, thank you. I'm going to tell you how I'm feeling today. And this was all around everything that I've just spoken about that happened with the videos resurfacing on the internet and the collective pain that I've been experiencing. And the sadness about the silence that I see from friends. The friends who are closest to me are often the ones who are most silent and do not feel that they need to engage with this work because of their proximity to me. And so I thought, I'm not going to play this dance today. I'm going to tell you how I feel. I'm feeling really heavy. It's been a really difficult week for me for these reasons, and I'm hurting, and it would be really nice to have heard from you. No response. And I did the same with another four friends, so five in total, who I had been in dialogue with. And it was almost like, so it varied from one no response at all, and then the other four did respond, but not one of them was able to say, I'm really sorry, you're hurting. They all bypassed that. They totally ignored it and went on to talk about themselves. And all of them are white. And I thought, it's just really, and you know, I don't hold any hard feeling around that. But I thought, this is really curious. And this is why you see these breakdowns of relationships where people start to distance themselves, because there you are being vulnerable and speaking your truth, and it's not validated or honoured. So when I did this poll, we were talking about this, and I asked people to share. For those who were the 91% that said the more they started to share about racism or to, you know, at least try to have these conversations with friends, the detrimental impact it's having on their relationships. And I said, can you share more about what those experiences are? And so for many of them, it's not just with friendships, it's with relationships, and that they've been told that by speaking up on racism, they're bringing the mood down. If you only focus on race, then that's what you'll see. All of these comments that do nothing other than minimize and invalidate. And as human beings, especially if you are black or brown, we are so often not seen, heard or understood. We are so often dehumanized. And one of the ways to see, hear and understand someone is to simply validate their experience as truth and not try and bat it away and minimize it. So I was just being quite reflective, taking a step back from Instagram and just doing what I need to do to nourish myself, to build joy, and to just think about, how do I want to continue operating in these relationships? Do I want to engage in further dialogue? or do I need for my own peace of mind to let go? So to honour all of the advice that I give to others. And so I'm sitting with those for the moment. And then it just so happens that I tuned in to Brené Brown has a podcast. If you haven't already discovered it, where have you been? Subscribe. She did a brilliant two-part episode with Harriet Lerner, who is an expert in relationships and communication. And it just so happens that they did this two-part special that went out this week on why people find it so hard to apologize. And so with all of the work that I've been doing and you know, just talking about the hurt that some of us are feeling collectively and the sadness and anger around the silence in wellness communities, the silence in friendship circles, and how that hurts and how that silence often breeds and communicates complicity in some way. And I run, as you know, I run an anti-racism course for allies, a deep in-depth one where you really get to self-interrogate and find out what your inherent racism looks like, what you can do about it, and how you can, you know, understand systemic racism so that it's no longer complex and that you can start talking about this stuff with ease and calling other people and holding other people into account and advocating in communities and systems in society to help unlearn this stuff and stop repeating these cycles that continue to hold one race as more superior to another continuously. And within that course, there are modules on how you be a better ally. I even did it in my anti-racism Suffer Club. We spent a whole hour on apologizing. So this is before this, obviously before this, I've heard of Harriet Lerner and this podcast. And how, even in my TEDx talk, if you haven't seen it, I will link to it in the show notes. I talk about it right at the end, how difficult it is. In this context, we're talking about friends, but how difficult it is in general for adults to give a heartfelt apology and how often that is such an important component to being an ally and doing this work, apologizing when you do something to another that causes harm. So often doesn't happen. This hasn't happened with a friend I love dearly. This hasn't happened to, we've had numerous conversations about race and I still haven't received an apology for how their racism impacts me. And I've spoken about how hurt I am. And to this day, the apology hasn't come and it might not come. So when I heard this, and I need to be okay with the fact that it might not come. So when I heard this episode with Harriet Lerner and Brené Brown, Harriet Lerner said, "The people who cause us the greatest harm are the ones least able to apologize." Let that sit. I'm going to say that again. The people who cause us the greatest harm are the ones least able to apologize. And this can apply to relationships with your partner, mum, dad, parent. Yeah, this can apply to, you know, every facet of who we have intimate relationships with. But I'm applying it with an anti-racism stance because it just makes so much sense to me. And what is often getting in the way of people being able to give a heartfelt apology is their own ego. Them wanting to feel better, when actually when you receive a heartfelt apology or when you give a heartfelt apology, there's an element of you that is vulnerable because the person, the receiver, may or may not accept your apology. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't apologize. We should be doing it anyway from a heartfelt place, even if we don't fully understand what we've done to cause harm in that moment. And I talk about this in my TEDx talk. You apologize that regardless of my intent, regardless if I don't fully understand it in this moment, it's caused you, clearly caused you harm, and I need to take responsibility and accountability for that. So many adults fundamentally can't do this. The reasons? Low self-esteem, low self-worth, shame spiral. And that can look like, and that can come out as minimizing. Well, but you did this. Oh, well, not all white people. Deflecting. Denying that something even happened. And when we're in this state of defensiveness and denial, I talk about it in my anti-racism course around this work and white fragility, we are not in a state where we are listening and able to hear people speak their truth and honour that truth and validate it in that moment because we're too focused and centering on ourselves and our own feelings. and then nothing changes. And then also you've ended up causing more harm by giving an insincere apology. It's so easy to do, but yet so many adults, and especially those closest to us, find it extremely difficult. And it's all of those reasons I mentioned above. Often we find it difficult to apologise because we have our own low self-worth and low self-esteem. And low self-worth and low self-esteem can take on many different guises, including arrogance. Anyway, it's such a beautiful episode about why adults find it so hard to apologise, what we're teaching our children about not apologising, the cycle that that continues to have. And when I think about it in terms of anti-racism work and how we role model, how different bastions of society are held up in higher esteem than others, and how we role model how to talk about race or not, and how we role model how to apologise or not, because some people believe that by apologising, they're somehow going to lose respect. If you feel like you're going to lose respect, then my question would be, why is it you want to maintain power over somebody else? Harriet Lerner talks about that in that moment, about the fear of losing respect, and actually says the opposite. When you apologise from an honest place and you're vulnerable and it's a heartfelt apology, you do the opposite of lose respect, you gain it. And I say my anti-racism teaching, every opportunity we have with another human being, particularly white, black or brown divide, is an opportunity to increase connection with that human being or to break it, and to break trust, to build trust or to break it, to improve connection or to disconnect. We have a choice, and it happens at every single interaction that we have with each other. And a lot of, about this work, I speak about it in my anti-racism course around trust. One of the biggest forms of losing trust in another person that you care about is disengagement. It's the biggest form of betrayal, actually. So even if nothing, you might notice it in certain friendships, like nothing really, you can't really put your finger on what's happened or why there's been a breakdown in your relationship or why you don't feel safe around this person anymore. There's been disconnection after disconnection after disconnection, opportunities to build trust that have been broken down over a period of time. And that can show up as feeling betrayed by them. And often what happens in anti-racism work is so many white people, yes, I'm talking to you again, peeps, disengage with this work. And if you have friends who are black and brown, they are noticing your disengagement, and that is contributing to them not trusting you, them not feeling like you care about them. And of course, it doesn't mean that you don't care about them or you don't love them, but this is how this is manifesting. And it breaks down that trust. And we disconnect and we don't feel safe and we don't trust. And if you, you know, if you embark on my anti-racism course, you will understand more about the historical significance and the importance of white women in particular building trust with black women because of the way in which they controlled black bodies in the height of the transatlantic slave trade and used our bodies as a commodity, as a way for them to access wealth. And the violence inflicted on our bodies during this time when women were oppressed by men, and their way of unleashing their own oppression, they unleashed it on our bodies. There's so much historical significance to this. But being an ally, doing this work, is having an understanding and a holistic picture of that, and recognising how you are breaking down trust in your relationships with black and brown people because you're not doing this work, or you're half doing it. You've got one toe in and one toe out, and disengaging with the stuff that really makes you feel hard and uncomfortable and sad. Really, really, really timely episode. I would invite you to listen. It's an absolute masterclass. With Harriet Lerner and Brené Brown, and I'll link to it in the show notes. But yeah, I thought I'd just dive in, drop into your inbox this Sunday with some musings and just share a little bit about where I'm at and how this shows up in day-to-day life and how important now more than ever it is for people to be actively anti-racist. Before I sign off, I just want to read a segment. I've paraphrased it because it's quite long. It's part of a bigger article, and I will link to that as well at the end. I need to remember all these links. But I saw this yesterday, and it really, really encapsulated all I have to say about this past week, and the impact of this past week and the white silence and the impact of that has on us who are black and brown, people of colour. I just want to read this. There are white racists and there are white anti-racists. Not professed anti-racists who click the roof of their mouths, feel an initial wave of sadness at news of murders of jogging black men, and then move on with their day. Not anti-racists who endured grotesque racist dinner table diatribes from their uncles and mothers and husbands and choose not to speak because they don't want to deal with the blowback at home. Not anti-racists who absorb vile break room jokes and outwardly laugh along while internally feeling sick to their stomachs. Not anti-racists who scroll past the most dehumanizing memes and videos from people they've grown up with and gone to high school with, not wanting to engage the collateral damage of publicly confronting them. You oppose the inhumanity or you abide it. You condemn the violence or you are complicit in it. You declare yourself a fierce and vocal adversary of bigotry or you become its silent ally. And that's written by John Pavlovitz. And that last thing reminds me of the episode I recorded with Selena Barker, episode 3. Go back and listen if you haven't. Selena has been on an anti-racism journey for over a year now with me and has had a huge life-changing transformation from engaging in this work and leaning into the bits that make her feel shame. And when she got to an understanding that she thought, you know what, you know, she's seen those videos, you've seen the films like Mississippi Burning and films that were depicting the height of civil rights movements where you had, you know, communities of black people that had some white allies within there and, you know, painting everything about dehumanizing black people based on their skin color and hating everything about the idea of slavery. And she thought, you know what, I'd have been one of those guys that would stand up for this. I would do the right thing. I would speak up on it. I would not be complicit. And there was a learning, there was a turning point, a learning moment for her when she realized that actually her complicity, she is complicit, and her complicity looks like those white people in those times in the height of the civil rights movement who didn't like to see other people dehumanized, but stood in the crowds and watched when people were murdered because of the color of their skin and did nothing. That's kind of what we're talking about now in modern day. And I know it hurts and I know it's hard to hear, but it's important to speak truth because we are not going to make change bypassing the full extent of being human, the depth, the darkness, the pain, the anger, the rage. We're not going to get to collective wellness and collective healing by only focusing on the positive and ignoring a community's pain and grief and how they continue to be disproportionately impacted. Sometimes less by the actual atrocities, but the silence that surrounds them. And so, yeah, just reflect on that. See what comes up for you. Get curious. I'm going to leave some comments with the links of some of the references I've mentioned, especially about the apology and why we find it so difficult to acknowledge that we've caused another human being pain. Because that part of being anti-racist and being an ally is deeply, deeply vital in enabling healing and not contributing to more trauma, because that's what happens. There is a risk to us speaking our truth and giving you feedback about how your racism hurts us. And time again, as indicated in that poll I did on Instagram, 91% of people say it's had a negative impact on their relationship because they cannot apologise and say sorry for the harm that they've caused unknowingly. It's quite profound. It's something so simple, but not. Anyway, that's it from me. I'll be back with my usual episode on Wednesday. It's a corker. I say that about all of them, but some of you may know this next expert. And we'll be speaking a whole lot more truth to power there. And so, my friend, if my words are moving you today and they are calling you to turn lip service into action, my anti-racism course is ready and waiting for you, where we dive into all of this stuff, where I support you in self-interrogation and recognizing what racism looks like in you because it's there, giving you historical context about what's happened in the past and why it's relevant now, giving you the language, the tools, the knowledge and the skills to start holding people in your life accountable for this stuff when it matters the most, to start advocating in communities beyond just clicking a few likes on Instagram squares. I'll leave the details in my show notes, and also a reminder of Courageous Courage, my ally edition, is starting at the beginning of June. And this is less an anti-racism course, but much more practical in terms of recognising what's stopping you from being a better ally. What anxiety related to dealing with potential conflict or dealing with racism in the moment is stopping you from being an ally. Giving you tools and language and the confidence to start to tackle this stuff in an effective way, whilst looking after your mental health and building resilience as well, because we need as many of us to be resilient so that this work is sustainable as possible, more relevant for, more important for people who are people of colour, but equally important for you too, because you need to be able to withstand some of the stuff that I'm telling you and not shrink. Time to rise up, my friends, time to rise up. So if you're listening to this today, have a good rest of the Sunday. Whatever day you dive in, enjoy the rest of your day. And you can, as always, feel free to connect with me over on Overread Official. And if this episode resonates with you, please leave a review. I know it will definitely challenge you. And that's part of what this podcast is also about. Again, the full range of being human. Got to take the rough with the smooth. Thank you for tuning in. See you next time. Take care.